This episode is sponsored by ByHeart. For a wide variety of reasons, not every mother can breastfeed. So we would like to introduce you to ByHeart, the only U.S.-made infant formula with globally sourced ingredients to use organic, grass-fed whole milk.
ByHeart features a patented protein blend that gets closest to breast milk. ByHeart's blend includes the most abundant protein found in breast milk, alpha-lac, as well as lactoferrin, the number one protein found in colostrum.
ByHeart is made with certified clean ingredients, no soy, corn syrup, GMOs, or palm oil. The formula includes prebiotics and an 80-20 whey to casein ratio, just like early breast milk, which is tailor-made for the newborn's digestive system.
Curious about ByHeart? Redeem your welcome offer at byheart.com/podcast with code DRESSED for a limited time. Additional terms and conditions apply. That's ByHeart, byheart.com/podcast, and use the code DRESSED.
Menopause, perimenopause, these can be some of the most uncomfortable phases of a woman's life. If you find yourself in either of these, well, Hormone Harmony is here for you. Hormone Harmony capsules contain science-backed herbal extracts called adaptogens. Now, here's the beauty about adaptogens. They help the body adapt to any stressors, like chaotic hormonal changes that happen naturally throughout a woman's life.
Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And get this, Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it. But it's perfect for those horrible menopause symptoms that put a woman's life on hold.
Hormone Harmony uses only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. And the biggest benefit? Feeling like myself again, which is what women mentioned over and over in their reviews. And Cass, there are 17,000 reviews for Hormone Harmony.
For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use the code DRESSED at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code DRESSED for 15% off today. Dressed, the History of Fashion is a production of Dressed Media. Over 8 billion people in the world, we all have one thing in common. Every day, we all get dressed.
Where we explore the who, what, when, of why, and we are fashion historians and your hosts, April Callahan
and Cassidy Zachary. Dress listeners, summer is in full swing, and you know what that means. Lots of traveling and hopefully lots of museum visiting to escape the heat. And luckily for you and us, there are so many fashion exhibitions to quell your summer fashion history thirst. In London, you have Barbie the Exhibition, which is on view at the Design Museum until February 2025. At the V&A South Kensington, you have the exhibition Naomi, celebrating the 40-year career of supermodel Naomi Campbell.
And at the Palais Galliera in Paris, there is Fashion on the Move, which explores the history of fashion from the 18th century to the present day, featuring over 200 works which trace the significant relationship between the evolution of women's wear and physical activity. And that runs through September of 2025. While in New York, you can check out Statement Sleeves at the Museum at FIT, on view through August 25th, 2024, and Sleeping Beauty's Reawakening Fashion, on view until September 2nd. So many fashion exhibitions, Cass, in so little time.
And we have not even covered them all, of course. But one more to mention, if you're heading to Boston this summer, you also have until September 2nd to see the Museum of Fine Arts Boston's current exhibition, Dress Up, which just so happens to be the topic of today's episode. The exhibition features over 100 works of jewelry and fashion and explores the art and act of dressing up, something, of course, we are all well familiar with. As RuPaul has so aptly quipped, quote, we are all born naked and the rest is drag.
Today, we welcome the exhibition's curators to the show. Theo Tyson is the museum's curator of fashion arts, and Emily Storer is the Rita J. Kaplan and Susan B. Kaplan curator of jewelry. Theo and Emily work together to show the intimate relationship between fashion and jewelry and how they play an equally significant role in our own self-fashioning. We are so pleased to welcome them to the show.
Emily, Theo, welcome to Dressed.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, it's so lovely to meet both of you for the first time and to talk to you about your wonderful exhibition. But before we learn about it, I'd love if you could just each introduce yourselves and tell us a little bit about your unique roles at the museum.
My name's Emily Storer. I'm the Rita J. Kaplan and Susan B. Kaplan Curator of Jewelry at the Museum of Fine Arts, and I've been in this role for about 10 years. It's a really unique position, and I oversee jewelry throughout the collection from ancient to contemporary. The collection spans about 6,000 years and more than 20,000 objects.
Wow.
So it was a pleasure with Dress Up to be able to focus on a very small piece of history.
And what about you, Theo?
I'm the curator of fashion arts here at the museum, and I am coming up on year 3 in November, and I have the pleasure and privilege of stewarding our contemporary fashion arts collection.
Wonderful. And of course, jewelry and fashion dress go hand in hand, which is foundational to the thesis of this exhibition that we're here to discuss today. And that exhibition is called Dress Up, which explores and celebrates the act and art of dressing up. But before we learn more about it, I love asking our guests this question. I'm hoping you might first share with us your earliest memory of dressing up.
Good question. I remember as a kid with my sister having a dress up box that we would go through. My mother would toss her old dresses in, I think, and we would put on fashion shows for my cousins and our friends. But I remember an event that now as a curator makes me cringe at our church when I was a kid, where we had a fashion show where we wore historical costume on the runway. And I remember as like a 12-year-old being the only one who fit into this 19th century bodice and skirt and wearing that. And I think it was one of the first opportunities I felt like what it really was to like get dressed in something other than, you know, jeans and a t-shirt.
Well, don't feel too bad. I'm sure you know that the Met allowed people to wear their dress collection up until at least the 60s and 70s. And what about you, Theo?
It's actually interesting that Emily mentioned church, because in regards to dressing up, my sister and I were both so rough and tumble and loved our overalls. So dressing up was definitely sort of a Sunday activity. And both of us, I recall, we despised those little lace white stockings or the little short body socks, because there's actually a picture of my sister. She got caught in the closet trying to pull them up to her knees like basketball socks and rip the lace off. So we love dressing up, but only on our own terms.
This segues wonderfully into the exhibition, which has many great quotes on the wall. One of them, Kate Spade playing dress up begins at 5 and never truly ends, right? This speaking not just to this lifelong commitment to getting dressed, but also the performance of it all, which I think is another theme at the heart of this exhibition. There's another quote on the wall, "We are all born naked and the rest is drag," by RuPaul. Can you introduce us to this exhibition, perhaps starting with the impetus or inspiration behind it?
Sure. I think that those two quotes that you just mentioned really perfectly situate what went into putting this exhibition together, because we were really thinking about the performative act of dressing up, how it is something that starts when you're a kid, but that you do it all the time. And both of those quotes really speak to that. This exhibition came about back in 2018 and 2019, when the museum had been given a large collection of costume jewelry by a Canadian collector named Carol Tannenbaum. And Carol had invited me up to Toronto to visit her. She's a costume jewelry wholesaler. And so her whole house, 3 floors, are filled with jewelry. And I was overwhelmed by what there was to choose from. And before I went up, I had a chance to go through her books and look at what was included in the collection. And I narrowed what she had down to 8 different categories that I wanted to develop and build and bring back to Boston. Things like fashion jewelry, American costume jewelry, plastics, patriotic jewelry, for example. And so over the course of the next 6 years, you know, this exhibition had lots of twists and turns and was thrown off by the pandemic a bit, but it was all planned, maybe, because in the end I got to work with Theo. We spent 2 years, more than 2 years, refining the checklist and planning a much larger exhibition than I had initially planned. And what we came to in the end is that this is a collection and this is an exhibition that looks at the way that fashion and jewelry come together. And it's a little bit shocking. I think people are very surprised when we say that we think this is one of the first exhibitions ever gives fashion and jewelry equal attention, that for as related as they are, they're often in a museum context really considered separately. And so we're very excited here to be able to give them equal footing and be able to think about how we put looks together using both of those things. And we've included photography as well to showcase more of how you see yourself in the on the other side of the camera.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say giving equal weight in the exhibition to jewelry and fashion is not necessarily something I've ever seen. Certainly, there are accessories featured in exhibitions and exhibitions about accessories, but to center both of that as your driving theme, I think is really, really interesting and really impactful for people who have always dressed themselves, me included. I finish every outfit with a piece of jewelry, even if it's just a ring. I feel naked if I don't just have those rings on. So that's really interesting, right?
Well, and I mean, I think that's why it's probably perfect to start off with that RuPaul quote, because everyone has that one thing that they can't leave the house without. And I always joke, for the most part, we tend to leave the house clothed. So what is that one thing that we put on that we must have to be complete? And I mean, it actually even extends to beauty, if you will. Folks that won't leave the house without mascara or lip gloss or a tinted moisturizer. I know for me, it was embedded at a very young age. It's like, you do not leave the house without earrings on. And regardless of what you're wearing, it should just be clean and pressed. So the way that we've engaged with this exhibition and in looking at these things holistically, it's we all participate in this, whether it's costume jewelry, however you understand that, fashion, however you understand that, it's a mandatory participatory thing.
Absolutely. And now the wheels in my brain are spinning, because I realize too, when I put my jewelry on, it's to leave the house. So it is a performative act, because I'm not necessarily doing it for myself, although maybe it's an armor that I wear, but I'm leaving the house because as soon as I get home, I take that jewelry off. And I think we all probably have that relationship with dress and accessorizing, right? So yeah, really, really fascinating and something that we all surely can relate to. And the majority of pieces featured in this exhibition are new acquisitions for the museum, which is really cool. And I'd love if you could share for our listeners some insights into the museum acquisition process and how you go about selecting items for your permanent collections. Emily, you talked about, obviously, this is a private collector who brought you this huge, massive collection, but that's not necessarily always the case. And I'd love if you can enlighten us as to the different ways that you acquire pieces for the museum.
Well, even with that collection, I had to decide what I was going to collect within it and then narrow it down. And we're always working within a collection strategy that we rewrite every few years. So at the time that that gift was offered, I was working with a collection strategy that centered fashion jewelry. It was an area that I wanted to develop. And so it was perfect timing to get this call out of the blue, you know, offering this huge collection. But another new acquisition that's in the exhibition that also fell under this category is an ensemble by Jean-Paul Gaultier from his spring-summer 2019 collection. With my colleagues in the department, we were looking for couture collections that really looked at fashion and jewelry together. And in that collection, Gaultier had actually worked with a local jeweler who's local to us here in Lexington, Massachusetts, Mariko Kusumoto, whose work I knew because we had it in the collection. And her work is featured in a gallery in Cambridge. And so I was really excited when I saw that they had partnered on a number of ensembles in this show. At the time, she's trained as a printmaker, and she's worked as a really serious metal worker doing lots of very detailed works in metal. But more recently, she's been working in making textile jewelry. And Gaultier had encountered her work in the MoMA gift shop and reached out to her about partnering on this collection. And she went to Paris and lent these textile jewelry-like elements to a number of the ensembles in the runway. And so from that, we acquired an ensemble called Big in Japan that's actually the dress or the ensemble that meets you as you walk into the exhibition, to again speak to that intersection between fashion and jewelry that really lies at the core of what we want this exhibition to be about.
Emily started with this inspiration and this concept again over 6 years ago. So that piece was acquired with intentionality, but not necessarily specifically for this exhibition. But we did have an opportunity to acquire pieces specifically for this show. And one of them that really, I think, helps to thread the needle of the story that these objects mean so much and they can mean different things to different people as much as they have a certain symbolism that we all understand. So one of those is ring by a company called Of Rare Origin, the classic aviary ring, which is the one that was gifted to Amanda Gorman by Oprah Winfrey in honor of poet Maya Angelou when she gave her inauguration delivery. And of course, that was, could not see anything else when thinking about that ring, that Emily was like, oh, there's a whole nother story behind that. Emily, I hope that you will share. So we really looked at objects that would allow us to, again, we have a collecting strategy and we're always minding the gaps, if you will. And it's not just the gaps in regards to objects, it's the gaps that might exist in regards to narrative. Like, what pieces can we acquire that will allow us to tell unique and uniquely different stories? So in addition to the ring by Of Rare Origin, there are a few pieces from the collection of Donna Summer. There is an ensemble by Karina Emmerich, who was on a season 13 of Project Runway.
Yeah, and I yelped out loud going through the exhibition photos that were sent to me because, of course, I can't be there in person, but I was sent gallery shots when I saw the Karina Emmerich ensemble because she is a past dress guest and I'm a huge fan and personal collector of her work. And I love her. And she's not the only Indigenous representation in the show, but I feel like that's something that is so often excluded or looked over, although things are certainly changing within the museum sphere. But can you talk a little bit about why Indigenous representation was important for you in the show as well?
Representation in general was important to us for this show. Again, that was one of the reasons why we started with fairly specifically queer quote. That is the reason that we had the amazing photograph by Danielle Simone, by Timothy Westbrook, and the Dragon Sisters. With Indigenous representation, especially in this particular moment where there are so many museums and institutions that are removing those works from view or covering them up and not willing to engage with them. As Emily said, her collection crosses centuries and so many different cultures, and that's not something that we wanted to shy away from. And specifically thinking about dressing with respect to appreciation versus appropriation, we thought it was very important to show the objects as they were intended versus the way that they may be interpreted or worn by others.
So we have two instances in the exhibition where there's Native American material. So one is in a section called More is More that looks at the layering and stacking that's often done in wearing jewelry. And we have a section that looks at these stacked Bakelite bracelets. And then we have three mannequins in a vitrine, each with jewelry. And so we have a Hoochie caftan with Coppola Itopo jewelry. We have a Halston one-shouldered minimalist dress with Elsa Peretti bracelet and bag. And then we have an ensemble that we borrowed from the Peabody Essex Museum that belonged to Iris Apfel. And on this mannequin, which was styled by Apfel as she wore it, she's wearing a turquoise belt, a pair of bracelets, and six necklaces that are layered on top of one another. And the necklaces are from Pueblo or Diné cultures. But the way that they are there, I mean, they make this incredible turquoise statement. They're gorgeous, but it's very hard to see what's what. And to recognize that each one of those necklaces is a different style of necklace. And so in an adjacent case, we pulled out three necklaces from our own collection that are similar styles so that visitors can take a closer look and think about the meaning that these objects have within a community or culture. And then from a fashion perspective, there's always been an appreciation for Indigenous material from the fashion world, I think. And so here it gives us a moment to reflect on that. And then as you go around the corner, that Karina Emmerich ensemble that you and Theo both mentioned, you know, is paired with earrings that are by another local artist, an artist named Tiffany Vanderhoop. And this offered us this great moment to create a vignette in the exhibition. I knew of Tiffany Vanderhoop's work and was a big admirer of it even before I saw it paired with Emmerich's work, the Santa Fe Fashion Show in 2022 at Indian Market. And just like the Mariko Kusumoto Ensemble, this was an opportunity for us to put fashion and jewelry together. And we were really excited to do it. And as we started to think about what that might look like in the exhibition, we decided to pair that ensemble with a robe that was created by Tiffany Vanderhoop's mother, Evelyn. It's called the Raven's Tail Robe, and it was commissioned to be made for the MFA back around 2017. And when my colleagues went to Haida Gwaii to meet with Evelyn and to make a plan, she agreed to weave the piece for the MFA's collection, but insisted that it be danced before it come into the collection. And so back in 2018, or maybe it was 2019, we had a beautiful ceremony where she came and she danced the robe, and you could see the fringe swirling and see the textile really come to life in a way that it never would again once it became part of the collection. And at that ceremony, Tiffany was there. She beat the drum as her mother danced. And so to be able to bring Tiffany's work together with her mother's, it's really extraordinary because suddenly you see all these connections come together, some which we expected, some which were a bit of a surprise. For example, the fringe on the Raven's Tail robe so beautifully matches the fringe on Karina Emmerich's vest and then the fringed quality of the earrings. And so there's a nice little vignette that goes together there. But then separately on the wall, we have another pair of earrings by Tiffany that really connects more visually to her mother and her grandmother's weaving. It's black and white and yellow in the same way as the robe versus the Emmerich ensemble, which is red and black and paired with a pair of earrings called All of My Ancestors Are Watching, which feels so fitting in thinking about how all of that comes together in that space.
It's a really gorgeous corner in the exhibition.
Yeah, and made all the more so by that beautiful story. I mean, I guess you would never have any idea about kind of the thoughtfulness and care that went into your collecting practice. So thank you so much for sharing that with us, because that sounds like a really, really beautiful moment that you all got to share together and bring so much more meaning to that active practice of collecting pieces for a museum setting. So thanks for sharing that with us. Very excited for this show. I'm hoping you can, we've already talked about it a little bit, but can you maybe walk us through the exhibition for those of us who can't be there and maybe highlight a few pieces in each section? What can visitors expect that are coming to the exhibition, and then maybe bring it to life for some of us who can't actually make it there in person?
This is the hard part. It's like, what is your favorite piece in the show? This is a very beautiful asking of.
Yeah.
Of that question as we move through. Emily, actually, I think I'll defer to you to start, since this originated with you and even the Big in Japan piece that really starts the show, that's placed beautifully between this gorgeous gold lamé Bob Mackie with fur cuffs and a chevron silver sequined Alexander McQueen.
So yeah, you're standing in front of those three ensembles, standing on a black runway. And as you come through, you're met with these three ensembles and galleries on either side of you. And this is quite a departure from the exhibition that Theo and I first conceived of, which was in just a rectangular space. Suddenly, it became much bigger, and we thought about how these two different spaces could function. The exhibition is split into eight different sections that each create this moment, capture this moment to think about. But really, at its core, it's thinking about how we dress, how we put accessories, fashion, jewelry together to create a look that really communicates something about us on a particular day, at a particular moment, that expresses a mood. And as you've said, you know, this idea of dressing up is something that starts when we're kids, but it's something that continues as we live every day of our life, especially for special occasions. So if you take a left, you enter into a gallery where we play with this idea of dress up in a section called Child's Play. And here is where you'll meet that Kate Spade quote that you mentioned, that dress up begins when you're five, but never truly ends. And we have a bag, a brooch, and a dress that all have Mickey and Minnie Mouse themes, and then this really wonderful Herbert's photograph of Madonna sitting on a bed that Theo wrote a beautiful label about.
It is a super fun section, and that was actually made, and that was Madonna's first time out of the country traveling internationally. She was in Tokyo for her Who's That Girl tour, and that's really where she connected with Herbert's that did the photograph for her next album, which was True Blue. And even though that's where you start in the exhibition, it really sort of leans to this idea of, yes, we all started dressing up where we were children, but when did it end? or when did we stop enjoying it? When did that playfulness end? And one of the things in that label about Who's That Girl, as Madonna said, it was about playing different characters and that no one would ever truly know who she was. And I think that most of us know, I'll try not to date all of us, not just me by myself, I won't date us. But in that era, Madonna had a very particular aesthetic and look, much like the one that Iris Apple developed and became known for. So as you're moving through the exhibition, Emily mentioned that more is more category. We're looking at the ways that these things are developed. And more is more moves into identity politics, which is where those lovely Evelyn and Tiffany Vanderhoof pieces are, and Karina Emmerich. These amazing double-headed eagle beauties by Olivia Rousteing for Balmain. And that does take us to a gorgeous section of little black dresses, which is truly the canvas for fashion, whether it be jewelry, accessories. And of course, we have some commentary on Chanel there, and Emily can tell you about some fabulous Verdura cuffs that Chanel wore that are on loan. But we really start looking at how this shows up as an adult and how that performance is prescient and also necessary in the development of our identities and starting to interrogate and maybe in some cases even critique those influences. There's a section about shopping, which has the quote from Oscar Wilde that one should either be a work of art or wear a work of art. And so you move through that and then you flow back past these three gorgeous entry gowns into sort of a fantasy land, if you will, that engages Hollywood from the big screen to the small screen entertainment. And again, just this air and idea of fantasy and sequins and sparkles. And I think one of my favorite quotes from that section is one that Emily chose by Dolly Parton, that it's hard to be a diamond in a rhinestone world.
Cass, did you know that learning a new language is only helpful for international travel? Acquiring new language skills also has cognitive benefits and can improve brain function. Studies have shown that learning a new language can improve memory, problem-solving skills, and even delay the onset of dementia.
There are so many reasons to learn a new language, Dress listeners, and Rosetta Stone has been the trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Available to use on a desktop or an app, Rosetta Stone is flexible for when you want to learn fast by immersion.
With features like True Accent that gives you feedback on your pronunciation, to the fact that you get lifetime access to all of Rosetta Stone's 25 languages, this incredible offer solves all your language learning needs for life.
Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. Dress listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Dress listeners, it goes without saying that a lot of our shopping errands are made easier these days by shopping online. So why aren't you using Rakuten? Rakuten is the smartest way to save money when you shop.
That's right. You can earn cash back when you shop at 3,500 stores for fashion, beauty, electronics, home essentials, travel, dining, concert tickets, and more. How does it work, you ask? Well, brands pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and this is passed along to you as cash back.
From Sephora to Petco and Levi's to Expedia, when you shop with Rakuten, your cash back can be deposited directly into your PayPal account, or they will send you a check. Membership is free, and you can even maximize your savings by stacking cash back on top of other deals like store sales and coupons.
If you're already shopping at your favorite stores, why not save while you're doing it? Get the Rakuten app now and join the 17 million users who are already saving. Cashback rates change daily. See Rakuten.com for details. That's Rakuten. Your cashback really adds up. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. For many of us, the topic of self-care includes eating healthy and working out. But when you get busy, don't forget about your mental well-being as well. Therapy isn't for only those who've experienced a major trauma. For me, it's a tool to manage my stress and work on being the best version of myself.
So whether you are looking for a new therapist or trying therapy for the first time, BetterHelp is, well, here to help. Their online appointments are designed to be convenient for your schedule, and all you need to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And you can switch therapists at any time.
BetterHelp makes it easy to make your mental well-being part of your regular self-care regimen. So why not try BetterHelp? Take care of your body and your brain.
Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/dress today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/dressed.
I want to back up there for a minute, back to More is More and to the little black dress, because one of the things that I'm really interested in and have been over the course of my career, and maybe it's just like ignited in this show and I want to keep thinking about it, are the places where you have a fashion designer and a jeweler who come together to create a look. And so those bracelets that Theo mentioned that were made by Verdura for Chanel are a good early example of that. Verdura and Chanel met in the 1920s and they traveled to Ravenna, where together they saw the mosaics there. And from that came this design for a Maltese cross bracelet. And I imagine for many of your listeners, that's like painting a picture in their head of Chanel in the 1930s because she wore them all the time. Ultimately, Verdura made two of them. They're similar, but not totally the same. And she'd wear them as a matched pair, one on each wrist. And they really came to be part of her look and part of her style. And of course, she was so known for creating that little black dress that everybody could personalize through their jewelry and accessories, and became known for those layers of jewelry. One ensemble that we hoped to have in the exhibition but weren't able to get was one of Karl Lagerfeld's first looks that he sent down the runway in 1983, the homage to Coco Chanel, that's embroidered with layers of necklaces and bracelet. Jewelry was such an important part of that. But we have other places where a similar story is told. For example, a little-known designer, I think, probably not so well-remembered, Lydia Coppo of Coppola e Topo, who was working in Italy in the post-war era, part of this Made in Italy movement that was happening for fashion and for design. And she had this thought that you should have a different piece of jewelry to match every part of your wardrobe. And so she was really designing jewelry made of glass and really high quality materials, and thinking about fashion as central to that, and partnered with a number of different designers over the years. And we show an ensemble with Pucci because starting in 1957, they were working almost exclusively with Pucci, making jewelry to go with those ensembles. And then we go to the 1970s, you think about this partnership between Halston and Elsa Peretti, for example, that really defined that languid luxury of the 1970s with the sleek minimalist styles and those great accessories, belts, jewelry, bags that Elsa Peretti designed that really defined that disco era in New York. So we're looking for key moments throughout the exhibition where we can show these very intentional partnerships that happen between fashion and jewelry.
And another intentional partnership that we showcase in that, as we're moving through that second gallery, we have a quote from costume designer Patricia Field, and style being the purveyor of identity. So when we're talking about dressing up, the objects that are used to dress up are jewelry and fashion and accessories, but we're really talking about style. And again, as Emily was just alluding to, these collaborations between designers was creating that brand identity. And that look that you immediately know when you see a Halston or the gorgeous gold bone cuff that we have on that mannequin that was designed by Elsa Peretti, you know, that Tiffany & Co. is still making tons of and selling millions, where it's just something that becomes an icon, if you will. Several iconic things exist in the exhibition, but one that I believe is really relatable is the vignette that we have for Sex and the City, again, starting off with that Patricia Field quote, in the way that she was able to create a character specifically through style, through jewelry and fashion, that became essentially a cultural phenomenon. Everything from the brooches that Sarah Jessica Parker made famous again, something that had been once considered perhaps out of fashion or not trendy or not for perhaps a younger audience. It was something that her character wore as Carrie Bradshaw. But then you started to see Sarah Jessica Parker as herself wearing some of these same brooches. There's one by Hattie Carnaby that we have this great photo of her wearing. And then Alexis Bitar is another one that she engaged with quite frequently. And unfortunately, I think we all have her to thank for Manolo Blahnik being a household name when she made that exclamation for them being an urban myth when she was in the Vogue styling closet in one episode, followed by the feature film where a pair of blue hangisi Manolo Blahniks stand in lieu of an engagement ring to the love of her life. And just in case there are still some people that have not seen it, I won't do any spoilers. But again, Emily and I have found, as we've been sharing this exhibition with people, even individuals that have not seen the series, the original HBO series, or seen any of the films or the, what are they called, the reboots, are familiar with Manolo Blahnik and those blue hangisis specifically because of the series. So it really does speak to the impact that clothing and dress doesn't just have on our wardrobes, but on our psyches and the way that we move through the world.
I mean, think about that, the relationship between shopping and our psyche. I think in that section called Dressing the Part, where we're thinking about from the big screen to the small screen, you know, what we see and how that creates this fantasy of how we want to see ourselves. And if we just get that perfect thing, then we'll be like that character. And so we have a number of dresses with Hollywood provenance and photographs that show stars in the exhibition. And alongside a beautiful picture, a photograph by Steichen of Merle Oberon, who's wearing stacks of glittering bracelets, as I'm sure she did in many, many films, we have a series of bracelets there that are made in plastics and glass and base metals, the kind of thing that somebody could pick up at a department store in their local city after seeing these glittery, glamorous styles of Hollywood on the big screen. And so I think we think about in this second space the way that people engage in this material. And in the final section we call the Theater of Everyday Life, we ask visitors to think about what they might choose to wear and what they might wear it with. And in that space, I hope that visitors are either introduced to or reintroduced to a number of names that were very well known and popular in their day that just aren't anymore. Names like Miriam Haskell, like Eisenberg, like Trafari and Coro, and that they realize that here, we're in Boston and just down the road in Providence, this was considered for much of the 20th century to be the jewelry capital of the world. There were more manufacturers working in that city making jewelry than anywhere else. And many, if not most, American costume jewelry examples were made there, either in southeastern Massachusetts or in Rhode Island. And I think it's interesting to be able to tell that local story and if and either to remind people that local story exists or to let them know about it for the first time. I think it lets people see things in a new light. Another thing I hope they take away from the exhibition, but from that section in particular, is the complexity of the designs of many of these things. I think in some ways, because the designers who were mostly based in New York weren't limited to costly materials and precious materials, they had maybe more freedom to do things. And so you do see a lot of techniques that you would expect to see in fine jewelry used here in non-precious materials. Things like dress clip elements built into necklaces or double clip brooches, brooches that can be taken apart and worn separately, a necklace where the pendant can be taken off and worn as a brooch. I think these are so creative and they say so much about the design of that era and of the consumer and collector agency that they could have and how they wanted to put something together. I think that's why many of these jewels continue to be sought after collector's items today. And so I think there's you can read this exhibition on many layers, and there's a lot to take away.
And I think in regards to representation, Emily, what you were just talking about, there was also an intention for local representation to make sure that we featured queer designers, women designers, designers of color. And part of what and I'm using the phrase costume jewelry loosely, but mass production and industrialization in general created this very democratic approach to dressing that allowed people that maybe should not have, depending on certain societal views, or maybe simply did not have access to these things, now had the means or at least the inspiration to self-fashion themselves in a particular way. So that is something that we kept in mind as we were curating the exhibition. We also had the pleasure of being inspired by our MFA teen program participants that kept us on our toes and pushed us further into understanding these things from the 20th and 21st century when they consider the 20th century the 1900s. So making those connections in the way as much as things change, they stay the same. And that creates room for innovation and new study and perspectives. I think that that's something we're really hoping for with this exhibition. I walked through the galleries the other day on my way to a meeting and seeing the very inclusive and diverse and intergenerational group of visitors that were there, and not just present, but present and engaged, not just with the objects, but with each other, the conversations that were sparked, the memories that were inspired by a particular belt or shoe. I think that is probably one of the greatest hopes that we have as curators, is to provide something that is meaningful, useful, and joyful for our audiences, and to do it through something that people, again, naturally do every day. We're going to have a lot of fun with this summer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I would say you absolutely have achieved that. So congratulations on this wonderful exhibition that is running through the entire summer, Dress Listeners. So if you want to get out to Massachusetts and MFA Boston and see it, you have until September 2nd. Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you both so much for joining me. Is there anything else you want to add in closing? Any special experiences or pieces or moments that you'd like to share before we go?
I guess I hope the Dress Listeners can just take away, of the many things we hope they can take away, one is that jewelry can be so meaningful even when the materials aren't necessarily expensive. And one of the things that we put together that I think we're both very proud of is a little vitrine that has the AIDS ribbon in it, the simple red ribbon with a safety pin. And all that that represents, I think, in terms of the communicative devices that jewelry can be and the way that jewelry can serve as an educational tool. We have it positioned across from a denim jacket where we have a series of patriotic pins that were made in the years around World War II. And through both of those sections, or that whole section, but those two vitrines, we really want to think about the way that jewelry can communicate and what it says. Sometimes it can be the entree into a conversation, but sometimes people look at something and they know instantly what you're saying with that, a political button or a ribbon or something like that. So I hope that people leave the exhibition and that it sparks all kinds of conversations about their own wardrobe, their own experiences that just keep going.
And did you have anything to add, Theo?
Couldn't agree more with what Emily just said. The personal is political. And through this show, I hope that folks are able to see that it is also fashionable.
Well, thank you both so much for joining me. This has been a real treat.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Emily and Theo, for joining us. Dress Listeners, a reminder that you have until September 2nd, 2024, to make it to the Museum of Fine Arts Boston to see this exhibition. And summer is certainly the time for travel, Cass. Do you have any big, fun summer plans?
Well, I am desperate to make it to New York to see the Sleeping Beauty exhibition.
See you soon.
Plan on seeing me there. I'm also very much looking forward to, of course, SWAIA, the annual SWAIA fashion shows at Santa Fe Indian Market. So much fashion history, so little time, as you already said in the intro. What about you? What do you have going on?
Well, I'm making a pilgrimage to Fire Island for a bit, so don't call me friends. I'll be at the beach.
Non-fashion history happenings,
yes.
Although I'm sure you will bring a book or two.
I do it every time, and my friends make fun of me. I'll be like reading a fashion book. They're like, girl, really?
Disconnect.
Yeah. So speaking of disconnecting, Dress Listeners, we have a little bit of news. The first of which is that we are going to take a wee bit of a summer hiatus to do all of these activities. In the meantime, we're going to be airing some of our favorite dressed episodes from the archive of 499 episodes. That's right. This episode that you're listening to right now is our 499th episode. This is going to be our last brand new content episode until August 14th, when we will be back with new episodes, and the first of which is obviously going to be our 500th episode. Can you believe this?
I cannot believe it. It's crazy how time flies. So the first episode of Dress actually debuted April on February 27th, 2018. So we are now fast forwarding 6 years and we've done seven seasons. We're in the seventh season right now and 499 episodes. And Dress listeners, we could not have done it without you. Thank you so, so much for your support. And we love you all. And in celebration and as a huge thank you, it's only fitting, we feel like, that you are part of the making of that landmark moment of the show.
Yes. And to thank you and make you part of our celebration of reaching this landmark, we're actually going to record our 500th episode live online Sunday, August 11th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And we hope that you will all join us online for this free celebration. You're going to hear not only from past dressed guests about their favorite objects and maybe even stories or moments from fashion history. You will also hear from those of you who choose to take part in our Q&A. So this event is free, but space is limited online. So please head over to dressedhistory.com to reserve your spot for the festivities.
DressedHistory.com is also where you can check out our latest offerings from the Dressed History universe. That includes my upcoming Worn to Win, Dressing the Summer Olympic Athlete class, which is a one-off live lecture exploring 2,700 years of Olympic fashion history. And you can also still join my ongoing monthly series, What Women Wore to the Revolution, which explores the innovations of fashion and women's lives across four of the most iconic eras in fashion history. You can sign up at DressedHistory.com.
And dresshistory.com is also where you can learn more and sign up for my Fashion History Fridays at the Met in New York City. And while we might not be releasing new episodes for the next few weeks, I will still see you all at the Met. So many of you have signed up for tours in July. So please join me, anyone who hasn't already, for a 90-minute tour of the Met's most fashionable masterpieces, starting in the ancient world, fast-forwarding all the way into the 20th century.
Yes. Highly recommended and not biased at all. It's truly an enjoyable experience. And Dress listeners, don't forget you can write to us at hello@dressedhistory.com or direct message us at our Instagram, dressed_podcast. You can find the Instagram content directly connected to this episode at #dressed499. That's dressed499. And don't forget, if you need some summer reading at the beach like April, you can find a link in our show notes that will take you to our Dressed bookshelf with bookshop.org, where you will find links to purchase over 150 of our favorite fashion history titles.
Love Dress, but want to skip the ads? Consider subscribing to the ad-free version of the podcast for just $3 a month. You will find a link on our show notes to subscribe to the exclusive content version of Dressed, and that is ad-free. That does it for us today, Dress listeners. Thank you, as always, for tuning in, and more Dressed coming your way very soon. Dress, the History of Fashion, is a production of Dress Media.
During the summer, I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep me and my family hydrated and refreshed. It really is sourced from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient aquifer, 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements. As the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium water bottle brands, giving Fiji water its soft, smooth taste. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, its 330-milliliter and 500-milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water. Get stocked up on Fiji water this summer and visit your local retailer to pick some up today for your next backyard party, beach or pool day, hike, or even your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
Wayfair's Labor Day clearance is back, and we're bringing end-of-summer deals right to your doorstep. Now through September 3rd, score up to 70% off all things home. Get in on low prices while temperatures are still high. Like up to 70% off rugs, up to 50% off bedroom furniture, up to 50% off dining furniture, and up to 60% off living room seating. And the savings don't stop there. End summer with can't-miss surprise flash deals, all with fast shipping right to your doorstep. Save big on everything you need, with every style, for every home, for every budget. Modern? Check. Classic? Check. Coastal grandma with a hint of boho glam? Check and check. Wayfair's got everything you need to make your home way more you. Shop Wayfair's Labor Day clearance now through September 3rd for up to 70% off. Because at Wayfair, new season means new savings.
Wayfair, every style, every home.